Cape Talk.
Plan B.
Hello, Rebecca.
Hello, John.
How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. And yourself?
Are you paying your taxes?
I mean, yes. Very, very sticking to the letter of the law. And yourself?
I am. I would prefer not to be paying my taxes, but I see that I have no choice. The moral value of paying my taxes is debatable, but the potential consequences for me if I don't pay my taxes are such that I pay my taxes.
Yes, I think it is that little clause that dictates that SARS can actually enter your bank account and remove things. That scares a lot of people. But it is interesting, John, this notion of tax morality, isn't it? With the finance minister this week blaming the substantial hole in SARS revenues on weakening tax morality. And as a lot of people are saying, is there anything moral about feeding endless taxes into a state that seems to reserve them increasingly for, you know, the wrong purposes, for personal enrichment? Is morality really the word we should be going for here?
I don't know what word we should be going for. I'm increasingly getting people saying to me, either on the phone or through WhatsApp or whatever, can't we start a tax revolt? Mm. Can't we ask Alter to set up a trust fund and pay our taxes into that rather than to SARS? And it's a story that you have been following. Thank you for doing the work, because that means I don't have to. And you've written about it on the Daily Maverick. And it really is very difficult, other than for the very wealthy who have the ability to take their money offshore and put it into Panama or paradise. Mm. It's very difficult not to pay your taxes.
That's right. So I think this is a province of the wealthy. There may to some degree be a certain amount of tax mutiny happening in South Africa, but it certainly is restricted to high-end individuals. So what I discovered through chatting to tax experts this week is that, as you say, wealthy individuals are moving money offshore, or alternatively, if they have businesses that do part of their business in other countries, they're moving their businesses to be mainly domiciled there. Reports of farmers moving part of their operations out as well as a possible prelude to immigration, which is obviously a separate issue. Older wealthy people particularly worried about the recommendations of the Davis Tax Commission, so looking into a future in which they tax more on estates and a future wealth tax, so they're getting money out too. And then, of course, there are means of paying less tax in South Africa, again, if you're rich. So certain ways of setting up businesses in terms of paying out dividends and then giving money to charity. You know, if you really feel strongly that you don't want to pay money to SARS, you would rather pay it to charity, then you, of course, you can do that, and it is tax deductible. But again, that is premised on the idea that you have enough money to essentially throw away to charity.
The poor and the middle class generally pay VAT, and there's no way to avoid paying VAT.
Unless you do all your shopping at the airport or something.
Yeah, and people are bartering to avoid giving money to the fiscus. But that, I mean, that's a tiny seed, I'm sure. And PAYE, you've got to persuade your employer not to send your PAYE deduction to SARS. And there are not too many employers that are going to risk the legal consequences of withholding PAYE.
That's it. If you are a salaried employee in this country, your opportunities to meaningfully revolt against the tax system are extremely limited. You can make some small principled stand, if that's what you want to call it, by, for instance, not paying your TV license, not paying your e-tolls or rates and levies. But these are very small nyana, as they say, measures. The only way in which a full-scale tax revolt could succeed, John, is, as you say, if companies, if businesses were to get together and agree to withhold PAYE, which is, of course, illegal, and, you know, they'd be facing the consequences of that. That's not going to happen, realistically. So the question is, where's this hole in the SARS revenue coming from? It's $21 billion from personal taxpayers. And sadly, the answer is probably not, in fact, that there is a meaningful, huge tax revolt going on, but simply that people have less money to pay in tax, that people are unemployed, that the recession has taken a terrible hit, and that there simply isn't that money anymore. So Jigaba's point about tax morality is probably true up to a point. I mean, I certainly see and hear a lot of discontent from South Africa's taxpayers about what they're paying and why. But the notion of a tax revolt that could bring this country to its knees is still a pipe dream for those who would want it.
I mean, I suspect some people, particularly in the small business space, are hiding income, and people with multiple streams of income are hiding income. They're making a kind of they're making a calculation that SARS is less efficient now than it was 10 years ago. 10 years ago, they were less inclined to do it. And if they had done it, SARS would have been much better equipped to track them down and extract the money from them. And maybe they're making a calculation now that SARS has become so inefficient that it's worth taking the risk. But again, I don't think the numbers are sufficient to justify the sort of notion of a widespread tax fraud.
And as I said, it's personal income taxpayers who are accounting for the major hole. Businesses are only falling short by $4 billion. It's personal income taxpayers who are falling short by a much more substantial $20 billion. But of course, John, also tax evasion, tax avoidance is nothing new, as we are learning from the Paradise Papers. So I do suspect that there are people who may be pinning their attempts not to pay tax on principle or morality, when in fact this is, of course, an age-old game, even when governments are functioning as they should be.
You went with parliamentarians to UCT today. What was the purpose?
The purpose for me was to see whether MPs would be drenched in student feces, John, but they were not.
You had your camera at the ready just in case.
I did, and wearing a rain jacket. No, it was a very civilized meeting, as it turned out, between Parliament's Education Committee, the SRC, Fourlists, and UCT management. In fact, for those of us who are on the outside of this, quite a surprising amount of consensus, I have to say, on the big issues. If the Fourlists in particular hoped that they would be able to sort of get the MPs on side, I think they would have been disappointed in that the MPs were voicing a pretty hard line that they want UCT to be stable, that they want the academic year to finish, and so forth. And the Fourlist line is, of course, that the obsession of management with finishing the academic year cannot take precedence over these very important issues that they say. So even the EFF MPs on the panel were not necessarily, I thought, terribly swayed by Fourlist rhetoric. Probably the most inflammatory thing we did hear in that meeting was the suggestion by Masikole Mlandu, who's a Fourlist leader at UCT, that white people should pay for student fees, and it was expressed as baldly as that, and that coming on top of the tax issues we've just been discussing is probably unlikely to meet with a lot of popular approval. But the question of whether exams at UCT are also going to be allowed to continue is still a fraught one. UCT's Vice Chancellor Max Price is suggesting today that of the, 28,000 UCT students, he estimates a few hundred are actively engaged in protests. So they are literally, in the late 20s of thousands of students who wish to write exams. Fourlists, on the other hand, also saying that the SRC should not be the main negotiating party because they don't represent what's on the ground. I don't really see how.
Well, stand. If you represent what's on the ground, stand for the SRC elections and win them.
That's right. I mean, it is a democratic vote. I believe it was a low voter turnout, which has seen the DA Students Association organization win that. But Max Price also making an interesting, overwrought point there, that if the situation of Marikana taught us anything in South Africa, it is that authorities cannot afford only to negotiate with the kind of official named union, that you have to negotiate with alternative stakeholders or disaster ensues. And I mean, hopefully the situation of Marikana is a really hyperbolic metaphor in this instance.
We are reporting at the moment that there has been an unusually high number of suicides. Max Price was reluctant to call every single death a suicide. He called them unnatural deaths, which might be suicide, and it's a relatively low number in absolute terms, but in terms of a percentage of the student population at UCT versus the number of suicides versus the total population of South Africa, it is high. And I can understand it. I mean, I have a daughter who's at UCT at the moment, and she has access to all the middle class support that middle class parents can offer their children, and the levels of stress with her are very, very high. So for students without that comfort level that a middle-class household can give, I can't imagine what it must be like.
And this was a point raised by the student negotiators today, that suicide is a really hot-button issue for them at the moment. And a suggestion from Fourlist Mlandu that it goes hand-in-hand with UCT's sort of frigid and unwelcoming institutional culture for black students in particular. But, I mean, this is not a UCT-specific problem, John. It really isn't. There's global research to suggest in particular that student suicides rise in times of recession, in times of financial stress. So it seems to me also that this period of turbulence regarding what's going to happen with fees, what's going to happen with increases and so forth, may well be stoking mental health issues and anxieties and that stress among students. And as you say, there are a whole raft of other reasons why students are susceptible to suicide, including that you're often taken from your support base, shoved in an alien environment, and there's a lot of stress. But certainly this incredibly fraught culture of protest paired with financial stress, I can't imagine, is doing much good either to students who are vulnerable to mental health issues.
Suzanne Daniels described a meeting that she had with Ben Martins, who said he wasn't at that phantom tea or coffee meeting, and AJ Gupta was there, and an unknown Chinese person was there, and Salim Esser was there, and it was all around the court case involving Brian Malefe's pension payment. Should it stand or should it not? And Ben Martins has said no, he wasn't there. But Suzanne Daniels said AJ Gupta was wearing a grey tracksuit, a T-shirt, and no shoes.
Well, for me, that's really the straw that broke the camel's back when it comes to the Guptas, John. I mean,
you were prepared to tolerate them in the body politic until you heard that they went into meetings barefoot.
Right. Been a bit meh, been a bit blah about them, but now enough, John. We have to kick them out of the country. Seriously, though, this question of when it is okay to be barefoot is one that I think we need to set straight for once and for all here. So I have prepared a small, very short guide.
I suspect I'm going to disagree with you. I'm a barefoot farm boy from the Eastern Cape, so barefootedness is an essential part of my identity.
That brings me to my first. Are you on a farm that you own or work at? Be barefoot. Are you having a picnic on the grass? Be barefoot. Are you on the beach at a pool? Be barefoot. Are you at home relaxing in the comfort of your lounge or garden, loved ones around you? Be barefoot. When is it not okay to be barefoot, John? Assuming that you have the financial means to purchase a pair of shoes, and I think we can all agree the Guptas probably have several pairs of shoes. I would suggest it is not acceptable to be barefoot at a shopping mall.
Why not? Because what makes your feet more problematic than your shoes? Because your feet are working exactly where your shoes would have been walking. And there is no evidence that nasty things stick to the bottom of your feet more than they stick to the bottom of your shoes. So what is the difference?
Then why do people always get weird fungal infections in their toes from public showers, John? And anyway, you
I've
and I
never
have had,
been to a public shower in the Isles of Pick and Pay, Rebecca.
You and I have had this discussion before, and I believe I conclusively bested you by pointing out that there is a reason why it is not considered acceptable for somebody to wash their feet in a public sink, but it is acceptable to wash your hands, despite
but it's
your
not acceptable
claims.
To wash your shoes either. So my point remains.
Well, it's not
what
okay
is
to wash your,
between...
wash your gloves either. I mean, it's just not okay to wash your clothes in a sink. Let me continue. It is also not acceptable, in my view, to wear no shoes in a nightclub, also for your own personal safety, given stickiness, glass, and people trampling
needles.
On you, needles as well. Finally, John, it is not okay to be barefoot when you are arranging a meeting in Melrose Arch to arrange state capture. At the very least, have some respect for the people you are trying to intimidate, bully, or bribe.
There is a shoe brand, I can't remember it, but Emilio Butragino or something like that. They should have been wearing that. But I disagree with you very, very, very firmly about supermarkets. I mean, one notices, because it is out of the ordinary. But those feet are no more, or those feet are no less hygienic than those same feet clod in a pair of shoes.
If you are a podiatrist listening to this, I would really welcome your input on this, as John has clearly lost control of his senses. I'd like some backup, please.
All right. Backup. I also would like some backup, please, so that I can deny having been comprehensively bested.